you read all these, I mean, it's a Tibetan word, and people translate it in all different ways. And they call it delusions, they call it afflicted emotions. Some people call it afflictive emotions. And you see all kinds of strange words used to describe what in Tibetan is called nyomong and what in Sanskrit is klesha. So I'm going to go over what's a mental affliction. You know, because I don't know if you had any afflictive emotions today. You know, so I think it's important to talk about it in plain English, and I think it's very important to know what we're talking about. Who's the enemy? You know, who is the enemy? So you have to be able to know what a mental affliction is. Like, you sit there and say, do I have any afflictions? You know, do I have any mental afflictions? Do I have any delusions? Do I have any afflictive emotions? You know, and I think it's important to decide just exactly what we're talking about. And then we have to talk about why are they the enemy. And then you have to talk about what kind of war you're going to make against them. Okay. So first, we're going to cover mental afflictions from a rather dry monastic textbook philosophical point of view. Then we'll get into more fun, which would be Master Shantideva's description of how to wage war against them. And it's very cool. I mean, his plan and his strategy for waging war against something in your own mind is very beautiful. But first we'll go through this usual thing that monks like to do, is like this long definitions of stuff. Okay. Say nyomong. Nyomong. Nyomong is the Tibetan word for mental afflictions. Sometimes I like to translate it as bad thoughts. Okay. It comes from a Sanskrit word, or it's a translation of the Sanskrit word, klesha. Okay. And klesha comes from a Sanskrit root called klish. They put roots like this in Sanskrit. The root is klish. Klish means to bother somebody, to disturb somebody, to irritate somebody, like that. That is the root of the word for mental affliction. So I kind of don't mind the word affliction. It's a little bit long. But afflict or distress or bother you. It bothers you. It harasses you. Harass is a very good word for klish, okay? It harasses you. It's a thought which harasses you. And klesha comes from the Sanskrit word klish. I'll put the definition of a nyomong, and then we'll get into the different kinds of nyomongs, okay? If you read the reading for tonight, Geltab Jay says, I don't have time here to put all the definitions and the categories and the descriptions of the different mental afflictions. You should check that out from other books. So I'm going to give you some of that from other books, okay? Say, semgyu. Mashiwar Chepe Semchung. Semgyu Mashiwar Chepe Semchung. Okay. Semgyu means the stream of your mind. Okay? Your mind stream. Stream of your mind. Shiwa means what? Peace. Shiwa means peace. Mashiwa means no peace. Okay. Mashiwar Chepa means makes no peace. Means ruins your peace of mind. Okay? Ruins your peace of mind. Upsets your peace of mind. Semchung means a mental function or a thought. So roughly you can define a mental affliction as a thought which ruins your peace of mind. Okay? The technical definition is a little bit longer, but that's the guts of it. It's a thought which upsets your peace of mind. So if you want to know if you're an arhat yet, you just see if you ever have any thoughts that ruin your peace of mind. Okay? If you don't have any more, you've reached nirvana. Okay? And that's why nirvana is called... Another name for nirvana is Shiva. Okay? Shiva means peace. Real peace. Okay, it means you wouldn't have any bad thoughts in your mind anymore. Okay, nothing would upset your peace of mind. And it's sometimes hard to imagine. I mean, I like to say, try to sit there, close your eyes, you know, think of what it would be like if you never felt jealousy again, ever. You know, think of what it would be like never to feel jealousy again in your whole life. You know, I mean, just to eliminate one mental affliction, like my favorite, jealousy, you know, to just never have it again. I mean, what would it take not to ever have it again? The least bit of jealousy again, ever again. And that's what we're talking about, okay? I mean, you can sense what kind of peace of mind it would be, and you can sense how pleasant it would be. I think it would be like being on some kind of good drugs or something, you know? It would just be very, very sweet and peaceful, and your mind would be very, very quiet and very happy, and nothing would be disturbing your mind. Okay, I mean, in the immediate sense, mental afflictions hurt you because they make you unhappy. Okay, how they hurt you above and beyond that, we're going to talk about when we reach the root text of Shantideva, Master Shantideva. We're going to get to that. But in the immediate sense, and from the definition of a mental affliction, they ruin your day. They just ruin your time. They make you unhappy. Okay. Aside from all the other problems that we're going to talk about, the immediate effect of a mental affliction is that as long as you have it, which can be 2 minutes to 2 days or whatever, two years or 20 years, it makes you unhappy while you have it. Its function is to make you unhappy. Okay? If you're unhappy, you have a mental affliction. Abhidharma Kosha says there is no virtuous unhappy state of mind. That's very heavy. Except for, can you guess? It's a there's one kind of regret over having done something bad. You know, like feeling stupid over doing something wrong is like a sort of an unhappy thought, but it's a virtue. If you feel stupid that you said something bad to somebody, or you feel stupid that you had a dirty thought or something like that, that's a virtue. But the Abhidharma is interesting. It says, aside from that, there is no negative or any unhappy state of mind which is not a non-virtue, which is not bad karma. Okay. That's very heavy. Okay. That's very heavy. It means every time your mind is the least bit unhappy, it's pretty much bad karma. Okay. Unless you're regretting something you did negative, you know. Okay? To be upset about your mental afflictions is a virtue. Okay? All right. In fact, in the reading next week, you're going to see, in case I die, I want to tell you. Somebody says to Gyaltabjay, I think you shouldn't be attached, you shouldn't have attraction towards the path, and you shouldn't feel hatred about your mental afflictions. And Gyaltabjay said, blows it away. You know, he says, of course you should be attached to the path, and of course you should love the path. And of course you should be attracted to getting out of samsara. Equally, of course you should be pissed off at your mental afflictions. And you should hate them. And you should attack them and spit on them and fight with them. You know, and he's quite clear. I mean, I've heard that many people have asked me that, you know. And he's quite clear. You'll read it next week, okay? It's in his reading, yeah. From the point of view of it creating new non-virtue, okay? It always does. It is non-virtue. Yeah, now the Abhidharma Kosha distinguishes between a thought being a karmic ripening, and they say that that's not a non-virtue. So from the point of it being a karmic ripening, like a traffic jam is a karmic ripening, it's not a non-virtue. But then they, at the same time, it's not contradictory for that result to be also a cause. They say any object, in fact, every object in the world that we experience normally is both a result and a cause. It's a result of the past, and the result is not non-virtuous, but as a cause, which is, and they say it's not contradictory for a thing to be a cause and a result at the same time, and in fact every cause is a result and every result is a cause, except they get into very weird ones like the last moment of samsara is a cause. I'm sorry, yeah. Well, anyway, it gets confusing. Yeah. Let's say the habit of getting angry. It's a ripening of a past karma. And from the point of view of being a ripening of past karma, that ripening is not a non-virtue, according to Abhidharma system. But from the point of view of its being a bad thought and disturbing your mind, it's a new bad karma. Okay. You can't. That's what I'm saying. I mean, mental bad karma. You do your purification. Regret is a negative thought, which is a virtue. It is. Generally. From the point of view of it being a result, it's finishing. From the point of view of being a cause, it's starting new. No, any thought, which is a negative karma, right? You're talking thoughts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, pain is not unhappiness. It's the associated feeling about it. Yeah, if you feel angry, if you stub your toe and feel angry, it's bad karma. You are collecting tremendous bad karma. Yeah. Right, yeah. Yeah, arhats feel pain. The guy who got cut up by the king of Kalinka, if you were in Barrie this weekend, felt pain, but he didn't feel anger. Big distinction. Or unhappiness either. He felt regret for his past deeds which caused it, and that's a virtue. Okay. That's how arhats think. They feel pain. There's a big debate about it. They feel pain, and they feel sorry that they collected the bad deed, but they do not, under any conditions, create a new bad deed by getting angry. Okay. Alright. Right, it's the reaction. Right, it's the reaction to the pain. Arhats feel pain. There's a big debate about whether arhats feel pain. And there's two kinds of nirvana, phlakte and phlakme. Nirvana with remainder and nirvana without remainder. As long as you have remainder, you're going to feel pain. And there's horrible, you know, the first Dalai Lama discusses this in his commentary on the Abhidharma Kosha. And he lists all these arhats who had horrible deaths. You know, one of them had it in a very horrible bar and all this stuff, and they have pain, but they don't feel any negative emotions at all. Okay, which I think must lessen the pain a lot, but that's another point. Okay, I'm going to give you the six top six mental afflictions. All right, these are the ones. These are the generals of the enemy, okay? This is what's usually translated as desire or attachment. I prefer to translate it as liking things ignorantly. Okay, we talked about it in Massachusetts this weekend if you were there. The definition of dvichak is not what you would expect. It's not like liking things means you don't want to lose a thing. That's part of the definition. You don't want to lose a thing. There's some object that you want and you don't want to lose it. But there's two other implications. For it to be the klesha, for it to be the mental affliction, you have to misunderstand the object. You have to be misunderstanding the object. Okay? To be a mental affliction called liking things, you have to be misunderstanding the object. And that by implication means that you would be willing to commit a non-virtue to keep it. Okay? You would be willing to commit bad karma to keep it. And those are two very important implications. That prevents people from saying that it's wrong to like nirvana. A Buddhist should just stay in your current suffering and reach some kind of equanimity about it. You know, where you don't want anything, even nirvana. you know, or you don't want to get out of nirvana, out of samsara, you know, you don't want to get out of suffering. You know, there's this kind of way of presenting Buddhism that you should sit there and the goal should be some kind of perfect equanimity where you don't care about anything. You don't feel good and you don't feel bad, and you don't want anything and you don't dislike anything either. And that's crazy. Of course you want, of course the Buddhas like what? Sentient beings. They like to get sentient beings out of trouble. They like to be in paradise. You know, they like to stay there. They don't like to go to hell. They don't like to be, you know, animals. You know, they don't like to have mental afflictions. You know, and of course they have likes and dislikes. It's not wrong to have likes and dislikes. It's not a mental affliction necessarily to have likes and dislikes. It's ignorant likes and ignorant dislikes. Okay, ignorant means you don't understand the object. You don't understand what you are liking and what you don't want to lose. Okay, when you don't understand it, it implies automatically that you would be willing to commit a non-virtue to keep it. Okay. Yeah. No, that's next step. It's ignorant liking itself. We went through the steps in Barrie, Massachusetts this weekend. There were six steps, right? And they were taught by, do you remember? Maitreya himself, okay? And there's a big distinction between liking something, which Buddhas also do, and which Arhats also do, and which people who reach Nirvana also do, and liking something ignorantly. Okay? And I'll give you an example of liking something ignorantly, just so you set the scene. Okay? You're not trying to reach a state where you're sitting there not liking anything or not disliking anything. I mean, you don't see pictures of Buddha paradises full of bad things and good things mixed up, and the Buddhas are sitting there like, I don't care, you know, I don't like them and I don't dislike them. You don't see tankas, you don't see these Tibetan paintings of Buddha fields filled with traffic jams and dentists are drilling your teeth and irritating people on the subway and the Buddha is sitting there in equanimity, you know, saying, I don't like anything and I don't dislike anything. Because that's the ultimate end of the Buddhism which is described in some places. You know, if you practice it perfectly, then that's what it would be like. You would reach a Buddha field where it looks like Manhattan, as we see it, as I see it, and the Buddhas just learn to put up with it in a perfect way. You know, that's not the point. Of course the Buddha doesn't want to be in a traffic jam. You know, and of course the Buddha wants to be happy. And of course the Buddha would be like to be in the nicest car he could be in. You know, why not? That's okay. There's no problem with that. Ignorantly means the following. We had a case today. Okay? Live case. Real case. It's like on TV with those police shows where it's real, you know. And we ordered this computer on the internet. It was like an incredible deal. You know, it's like $1,000 for a $5,000 computer. Barely used, you know. So we get it in the mail and the serial number scratched off. And so we had this little discussion in the Dharma office, you know. This is a really good computer. And we can save $4,000. And is it our responsibility to find out if it was stolen? Because all we did was order it on the internet, you know. And so we went through this karmic discussion, you know, like, how did we get this computer? Good karma. It was good karma, you know? It came from good karma. It came from providing somebody with something, you know? Giving something to somebody. And that's why we got this computer. So should we just give it up, you know? I mean, what are we supposed to do? How much responsibility do we have to find out where it came from exactly? I mean, is it really something we want to get into? You know? So let me say, maybe better, because if you steal a computer, you're just setting up the causes not to get a computer in the future. And if you got a stolen computer, it was because of a mix of bad karma and good karma. You know, you're going to get a computer which you can use, but it's also going to create some bad karma because you were involved in a chain of stealing. So that's not a good computer. You don't want a computer like that. You want a computer which you got honestly, because then there's no bad karma connected to that computer, and then you can use the computer nicely. And like that. So we just decided, we called the company and said, do you have a hotline? And they said yes. And we tried to figure out if it, you know, we told them we have this computer, because you can find out the serial number from inside the computer. And that's the way it should be. So ignorant liking says what? Ignorant liking says, I got this computer. It's not really my fault. The guy's selling it on the internet. I bought it. I paid good money. Okay, it's $4,000 cheaper for some reason. But ignorant liking says, I want this computer, and I don't really care where it came from. And ignorant liking thinks, this is the punchline, okay? Ignorant liking thinks that the computer came from the $1,000. That's ignorant. It did not come from the $1,000. It came from honestly providing people with things in the past and being honest. And now if you're dishonest, you'll lose it. You must lose it. Or you must not get another computer. So it's crazy. It's crazy to take a stolen computer. For a Buddhist to like a stolen thing is crazy. And that's ignorant liking. There's a real lifetime example. Okay, that's just ignorance. If you keep that computer, you're just ignorant. You're not a Buddhist. You don't understand anything. You have a mental affliction. Okay. Now, is it a mental affliction to like nirvana? No. Is it a mental affliction to like Buddhahood? No. Okay. That's fine. That's great. So you got to distinguish between good like, real, ignorant liking, stupid liking, and smart liking. Okay. And there's a difference. And we'll get into it a little bit next week with Gyaltsabje. Is it wrong to enjoy a good dinner? Is it wrong for a Buddhist to enjoy a good dinner? Does the Dalai Lama make faces at a good dinner? You know, he loves a good dinner. You know? Does Ken Rinpoche not like a nice dinner? Of course, he likes a good dinner. But it's the whole attitude that you have about it. You understand it as a result of your past karma. You dedicate it to your lamas. You dedicate it to all sentient beings. You do all the virtues connected with. You think of it as fuel for your body to serve other living beings, and then you dig in. You know, and that's not ignorant. That's fine. That's good. Okay. So say control. Control. Control is the opposite. Okay. People translate it as anger, hatred. In its rawest form, it's defined as disliking something ignorantly. Okay, disliking something ignorantly. Okay. In order to remove a yelling boss from your room, you yell back. That's ignorant disliking. Okay. Why ignorant? Karmically speaking, it's the only way to get him to come back again. If you wanted to choose the one and only way to get a screaming boss in your future, scream back. Okay? And how many times do we do that? In a day? You know, how many times during a day do you act in a way which is, if karma is true, is going to make the boss come back again just the way before? And we act like that. We act on both of these things. I can stand here and explain it, but then tomorrow, when someone upsets you, you will say something to them. That's ignorant disliking. That's number two. But I always have to say at this juncture, does that mean that if the boss comes in and abuses somebody, you should just smile and say, you know, I'm not going to say anything because I know if I say anything, it's bad karma and he's going to come back again. Let's just let him do what he wants. That's not true either. Okay, as a bodhisattva, you have to resist evil. You know, if someone comes in and is hurting someone else, you must resist.
Okay?
That's not ignorant disliking. That's very intelligently trying to protect someone or help someone. What's the difference? It's intelligence and it's motivation. You know, you are not hating the boss while you restrain him. Okay? I mean, if you hate them, you collect bad karma. If you look at them and pity them and then try to stop them, it's great good karma. It's excellent karma. Outwardly, the action is the same. You know, it may be necessary to say a rough thing to your boss to get him to cool out, but it cannot be done in anger. If it's done in anger with a mental affliction, he's going to come back again. If it's done out of compassion for the person that he's unfairly attacking or something like that, you just created an incredible good deed. And that's a big difference. Hector, yeah. If you, what's that? I think you get the virtue of regretting that you couldn't act. Okay? And if you have bodhisattva vows, you've also broken a vow. Because you didn't go to the aid of someone who needed it. Okay. So you get a little black and a little white, which is, by the way, most of our karmas are mixed. And that's why most of our pleasures are mixed up with some crap, you know? Okay. You know what I mean? That's most of our karmas, we can't really do a purely white karma, and it's also unusual to do a purely bad karma. They're usually mixed up, and usually anything nice you get has some bad aspects to it. You know, you finally meet the girl of your dreams and she has bad breath or something. And then, in the opposite way, something really bad happens to you, like you lose your job or something, and then you find out the next day that you've got a better one or something like that. I mean, your bad is never purely bad and good is never purely good because we are constantly doing karma which is mixed up. Okay. What's Nga mean? Nga means me. Gyal means Gyalpo. King. I'm the king. Ngagyal is the Tibetan word for pride. Okay? The Tibetan word for pride. But the elements mean I, king. Okay? Ngagyal. Alright? Ngagyal. There's like 9 kinds of pride. I'm not going to go into it. I don't even remember all of them, to tell you the truth. But it ranges from being proud about some quality that you don't have at all, to being proud about some quality that you sort of have, to being proud about some quality that you really do have, but you're proud about it and it's stupid. And then there's this whole variations, you know. But basically, pride is diluted no matter, you know, whether you really have the quality or you don't have the quality or whatever. So this pride is, it's also based on ignorance. If you have, by the way, you remember we had 3 kinds of compassion in Barry this weekend? I mean, there's normal compassion, there's compassion which sees the impermanence of the being that it's focused on, and there's compassion that sees the emptiness of the being it's focused on. And pride could, yeah, I think you could compare pride to that. Think about pride, there's normal pride, but you're just kind of focusing on yourself and say, oh, I'm so good, you know. I'm just saying that I think you could make it parallel. Then there would just be this pride about, let's say, your beauty or your intelligence or what you've learned, which is very common in Buddhism, like that. And you have some pride about it. But if you focus on the impermanence of it, then it's foolish. You feel very foolish. I have seen in my lifetime, I have known lamas that the newer students here will never hear of, you know. They were in their time the greatest lamas in Tibetan Buddhism. And I know that a lot of people here never heard of their name. So what was the use of them being proud about it? You know, I mean, I have known lamas that had memorized thousands of pages of text and who knew every tantric initiation imaginable. And you don't even know their names. I mean, they're dead and gone and you will not know their names. And what was the use of being pride? You know, what was the use of pride for them? If they, you know, suppose they had pride, which they didn't, but suppose they would have had pride. I mean, it just, there's no point to it. You'd lose everything. Even if you're some good, you know, monk who's very smart and very strong and very intelligent and very active and all. You're going to lose it all. And you know, people will be teaching Buddhism 15 years later and they won't even remember your name. Nobody know your name. So what's the point of being proud about it? From the point of view of emptiness, or understanding the dependent origination of your intelligence, or your health, or your looks, it's crazy. I mean, to feel pride, I mean, it's obviously stupid to feel pride for beauty, and models find out about age 30. You know, I have this model came for an interview a couple of days ago. She was a very famous model. Then she hit 30. You know, and it was like starvation city. She couldn't get any work at all. She couldn't find a job. So she's coming to apply for this job to go look at little rocks all day long. You know, because that's a very obvious case. You don't have to be a genius to see that beauty or physical strength doesn't last. But I think there's people among us, including me, you know, you think, well, okay, I'm not hung up on my handsomeness because I never had any. But my intelligence, you know, that's something, you know. I have that. I can keep that, you know, but you can't. You know, and if you understand where it came from not being proud. Okay? If you have any kind of good personal qualities, they say, for example, that the ability to think clearly is a result of keeping your morality. Okay? The ability to think and analyze things clearly and think intelligently, IQ, is a result of morality. So if you're proud about it, or you're doing some wrong things because of you're proud about your intellect, and you're not polite to people, or you're arrogant, or things like that, it's the best way karmically to be stupid in your next life, and to be stupid later in this life. You start to lose your intelligence. You start to lose your IQ starts to actually drop later in your life if you've been if you've collected bad karma early in your life. So there's no pride is just stupid. Pride is self-existently stupid almost. Okay. Okay. Excuse me? Intelligent what? Oh, he asked if there's anything such as an intelligent pride. There is a kind of self-confidence. You know, there is a kind of... there is a kind of pride which is like, I'm proud that I've been able to improve myself. You know, I've meditated, I've thought about the mental afflictions, I've thought a lot about emptiness, and I don't have as much desire as I had last year. That kind of thing is not, I mean, that's Americans would call that healthy pride, and there is a thing called healthy pride. I think you could almost call it rejoicing. It's almost rejoicing. It's like saying, honestly, evaluating yourself and saying, I'm better spiritually than I was last year, and I'm happy about it. And that's good. That's fine. That's a good emotion. Yeah. 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 Yeah, no problem at all. That kind of pride is great. Like pride in your work. Yeah, that's fine. And I think that's what he was saying. The English word pride, which we use to translate I King, has a lot of good connotations, and they are good. You know, to be proud about the quality of your work, or to be proud about your social service to other people, or that's all healthy. Again, the test of something being a mental affliction is if it disturbs your mind stream. And the healthy kind of pride just kind of uplifts you and makes you even be more noble than you were before. You know, I think you can test it that way. Yeah. No, I was just saying that ironically, like with most bad deeds, the very thing which you're proud about, you will lose by being proud. When it upsets your mind stream, when it makes you unhappy, or makes the people around you unhappy. We're talking about more arrogance. How's that? I mean, there's different forms, but it's the kind of arrogance which expresses itself in harsh speech to others, or being impolite or unkind to others, or, and that's as opposed to self-confidence, which is very compassionate to others or concerned about others and acts in a firm way to achieve the goals of living kind. That's great. That's fine. You know, I think, yeah, I guess you have to be careful with the English word pride. Okay. And there's a Nagyal in the secret teachings, which is totally, totally different. Okay. And I can't talk about it because it's secret. Okay. Marikpa. As one of the six big mental afflictions, Marikpa is not exactly the same as it is in the first link of dependent origination, for example, or as it is in the picture of the wheel of life about the pig and things like this. This Marikpa is this is ignorance. Marikpa means ignorance. Ma means not. Rikpa means knowing. This is more of a generally not understanding clearly things like the law of karma, the laws of karma. Okay, just not clearly understanding objects like that. We're going to get to the ignorance which is the root of all suffering, and that comes later. Okay, so this ignorance is more of a just not understanding generally things like the laws of karma. But that real nasty ignorance, which means grasping to things as being self-existent, it's going to come later in another one. Okay. Tetsu means doubt, but it's a special kind of doubt. You could call it lazy doubt, maybe. Something like that. Lazy doubt. Okay. Now, a Buddhist, according to all Buddhist books, you're supposed to be very skeptical. Okay? A good Buddhist is very skeptical. Okay? If a Lama gets up, I don't care if they're wearing a red robe, I don't care if they have their head shaved, I don't care if all the flyers say, former teacher of the Dalai Lama, okay? Which I've always heard, you know, I've heard people say that. Doesn't matter. When they get up to talk, a good Buddhist is supposed to examine each thing they say as if it was the first time you heard it. And it must make sense to you. And it must check out against everything you know. And it must be consistent with the other things they're saying. And they must be acting consistent with that. And if they're not, then have that's not tetsum. Being skeptical is perfect for a Buddhist. You're supposed to be. Okay? It prevents the next teacher of the Dalai Lama who comes next week, who says the opposite thing, and you go for that too. Okay? What I mean is, don't trust the flyers. Trust the words and trust what makes sense to you. And that's skeptical. Buddha said, don't accept anything I say until it makes sense against your personal experience, unless it's consistent with everything else I say. And unless you just generally can check it out and prove it, then until then, don't accept what I say. You know, don't, very importantly, don't diss it. Okay? Don't diss it while you're still not sure. That's very important. Okay? Michael Roach keeps talking about mind is different from body, mind goes on, sounds okay, I'm not sure. Like if you get into a state where you're not sure and you say, stupid, then you've made a mistake. You know, you don't diss it. What did Maitreya say? If you're not sure, put it on the shelf. Just shelve it. He says that in one of his scriptures. He says, if you're not satisfied yet that the thing is true, don't disrespect it. Just put it up there and say, I'll get back to that later when I know more about it. It came from a guy who said a lot of logical things, but that one I can't buy yet. So I'll just put it on the shelf. But don't say it's stupid or disregard it completely. Be very careful about it. Okay. But also just don't accept things blindly, no matter who gets up and says them. Okay. And that's a Buddhist's responsibility, and it's the duty that the Buddha has given to a Buddhist. You know, he said, check out everything Buddhist teachers say. And if you don't buy it, if it doesn't check against your experience, if it's not internally consistent, also, then wait and just check it out more. Yeah. Mainly relating to Dharma things. Yeah. Okay, now what's the opposite? Tetsom is different. Tetsom means doubt, where you're just too lazy to make up your mind. And you have to admit that a lot of your reservations about Dharma things are either laziness, or you don't really want to admit that it's true because it's not what you want to do. All right? I mean, most of your so-called doubts about Buddhism are either you didn't spend 20 minutes to really think it out, or the conclusion you came up with didn't fit what you really wanted to do, so you decided you would doubt that part of Buddhism for now. Okay? And that's tetsom. Tetsom means that. Okay? And that's very important, like, especially as you get into the secret teachings, I think. The secret teachings are built around certain attitudes, especially about your lama. And you have to make up your mind. You know, you either make up your mind that you're going to do it or you're not going to do it. If you're into that path, if you're committed to that path, if you've taken that initiation, if you're keeping those vows, then make up your mind and do it. And make that commitment that you've decided. But to sit there and say, well, sometimes I will, sometimes I won't, depending on how I feel, you know. Then you're not thinking clearly. Then you're not being logical. Tetsom is based on not being logical. Okay? It's where you just don't want to admit it because you don't feel like it. Okay? Or you don't feel like working it out in your mind. Most Dharma questions you can work out in your mind in about 30 minutes. You know, they are true. All the teachings are true. When you see emptiness directly, you will know that. So sit down with the ones that you have a problem with and figure it out. And then act on what you decide. Okay? And get rid of that. Then you will wipe out tetsu. Okay? Dawa literally means view, but here it means wrong views. In the list of the six big time kleshas, mental afflictions, it means wrong views. There are five flavors of dawa, and I'm going to go through them real fast, okay? There are five different versions of dawa. So sometimes when they present the main mental afflictions, they say the top 10, okay? So we're back to top 10, okay? Number 6 has five different flavors. 5 plus 5, 10. Sometimes when they present the main mental afflictions, the primary mental afflictions, it's five ones which are not philosophical viewpoints, and then five which are philosophical viewpoints. Okay? Five which are not worldviews, and five which are worldviews. Okay? So this, now we're going to cover five different worldviews you can have, which are big time mental afflictions. They're in the top 10. By the way, how many minor ones? 20, is it? 20. 20 secondary, 84,000 variations. Okay? Jig means destroy. Da means view. I like to call it perishable view. Okay? I don't like the word perishable because it's only on the side of bakery bags and says, you know, eat this within 3 days, perishable, you know. And the full form of this view is called Jigso Latao, which view of the perishable assemblage. It's like 24 syllables, you know. Assemblage is like you think of a GM plant, right? And it's very, very hard to translate. I almost can't blame all the lousy translations for this, okay? It's very hard to translate. It's called Jigda because it's focused on something which is going to fall apart and be destroyed. And it's also called Jigda because sooner or later you and I will destroy it. Okay, so those are the two senses of perishable. Okay. What does it focus on? Jigda focuses on me and mine. Okay? Me meaning Michael. Mine meaning Michael's arms, Michael's legs, Michael's mind, Michael's job, Michael's house, Michael's possessions. And it says to itself, these things are self-existent. Okay? So the word for number one wrong worldview, which is the nastiest one of all, which is the root of all problems, doesn't give you any clue about what it's really about. Okay? Jikta means focusing on me or my things and thinking these are self-existent. These are self-existent. Okay? And it gives you a real clue into how not having jikta could wipe out all your mental afflictions. If you didn't have jikta, if you didn't have this wrong view, number one, you wouldn't have any mental afflictions. Okay. For example, pride. Pride is focused. Okay. It's willing to fight for those things. What's it? Where did the good things come from? Where did your intelligence come from? Morality. Keeping your morality. If you're intelligent, it came from keeping morality. If you're getting more intelligent in this life, especially spiritually, it's because you're watching your morality. If you're better able to figure out what's the right things to do, what's the wrong things to do, and things like that, if you're better able to read scripture, if you want to get better, keep your morality perfectly. There's something about having something on your conscience that doesn't let you have wisdom. Okay? It blocks spiritual intelligence. It's very interesting. If you want to be able to read scripture better, watch your mouth. Okay? Stuff like that. Okay? This is the root. If you didn't have this one, you would look at your own intelligence and say, I have intelligence because I kept my morality. Okay? I have intelligence because I kept my morality. One kind of keeping your morality is not to say bad things to other people. Okay? But what does pride do? Pride says bad things to other people. Because pride thinks that my intelligence is self-existent. My intelligence is God-given. You know, I'm more intelligent than other people. Period. And I'll always be like that. Okay? That's pride. Pride. And then pride says something bad to someone, and as a result, you lose your intelligence that you're proud about. Okay? And that's the function of jikta. Jikta does not understand things. Jikta looks at something that belongs to you or yourself and misunderstands it and does bad deeds, and then you lose it. And that's jikta. If you didn't have that, you could not have a mental affliction. It's very interesting. What's the last mental affliction that anyone loses to reach nirvana? Eighth level bodhisattva. Last moments. Just before he reaches nirvana. What is it? He loses jikta in its most subtle form. And that's the last mental affliction. And then he enters nirvana. Or she. Okay? Very interesting. Okay? Jikta and wisdom hate each other. Jikta and knowledge hate each other. They cannot stay in the same mind. Hector and Tessie are translating this text by the first Panchen Lama, where they get in a boxing match. They are punching each other out, you know, in one person's mind, because they know that they both can't stay. Somebody has to go. So they're like, bam, 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 you know, okay. Tartha. Tartha is always misexplained in the Buddhist books, in English, okay? I think so. Did I just break a bodhisattva bell? Probably. Often misexplained, okay? Almost all the time misexplained, alright? Tartha means holding that things are either non-existent or that they never change. You have tartha in your mind all the time. Almost all the time. Now, Tessie, I ask you honestly, did you have a doubt that I existed since the beginning of this class, or did you have any feeling at all since the beginning of this class that I didn't move or anything like that? No. Okay, so what is tartha? You know, tartha means either you think something doesn't exist or you think it never changes. It's two extremes. Tartha means extreme views. Tara means extreme. Why is your root lama called Khen Rinpoche Geshe Lobsang Tar Chen? Because Tar means the extreme. Chin means gone. Tar chin means he went to the end. He reached the end already. Tar chin means gone to the end. Okay, so tar ta means extreme views. Hanging out here on the two extremes and not in the middle. Okay, one extreme is thinking things don't exist. One extreme is thinking things never change. Okay. Did you come into this room thinking, oh man, nothing exists, nothing ever changes, you know? No. I mean, can you consciously say that you've had this wrong view? No. Okay, it's very interesting. Tartar is an implication of the way you think, okay? And what I mean is this. If the way you think about things, if you are who you seem to be, which I don't know, but if the way you think about things is true, then either nothing exists or nothing changes. Now, what does that mean? Okay. If I am self-existent the way you're looking at me as self-existent, then either I cannot change or I don't exist at all. If I am really not your projections forced on you by your past karma, if I am any other thing than that, if I'm self-existent, if I'm standing out here external of your own mind, if I'm not your projection, I cannot change, or I must be non-existent. Either one. It's very interesting. If I existed the way your mind thinks I exist, I either couldn't change, or I wouldn't be standing here. So tartā is very subtle. Okay. I'll repeat it. If I were self-existent, meaning if I exist the way your mind thinks I exist, out here, on my own, independent of your mind, then I would never change. I would never move. I'd be stuck here forever. It would mean, for example, that everybody in the room sees me exactly the way you see me. If I had some external reality independent of your thoughts, then everybody in the room would either hate me or like me. And I would never change. And that's not the case. Or I just wouldn't exist at all. Okay. If I existed the way you think I exist. So tartā is a little subtle. You have to think about it. Okay. Yeah. Excuse me? Yeah, pretty general. Pretty general. But in the lower school, you'd have to use the other description of what it is to be self-existent. You'd have to use either causes or parts or something like that. Exist. Holding to the extreme exists, but the extreme doesn't exist at all. That's another problem. Okay. A permanent Michael Roach, which exists the way you thought he did, is tartā. It doesn't exist. Lokta. Two examples. Lokta just means straight wrong views. And two examples that they give are actively not believing and actively not believing that, for example, past and future lives exist. Now, are you having a major mental affliction if you say, I'm not sure if past or future lives exist because I haven't got enough information yet? Is that a mental affliction? No, that's being a very good Buddhist. Okay? You say, I'm going to put that on the shelf until he can explain it better. Okay? That's fine. That's great. Okay? But Lokta says, they don't exist. I decided. Okay? Chongzin. Dawa Chongzin. This is very easy. Dawa Chongzin thinks that all the other wrong worldviews are perfect. They're the best. All my other wrong views are great. Okay, I mean, beyond having those wrong views, you have an attitude about those wrong views that says, these are the best. These are definitely right. Okay, it's a way of thinking about your other wrong views. And you say, those other wrong views, those other four, are great. Those are the best. Everybody should have those. Okay. I'll translate the words in them for Dawa means worldviews. Chok means best, like the word coin chok. that means the three jewels, meaning best and rarest. And Zen means to believe that or to grasp that. Say Tsutum, Dang, Dushuk, Chongjing, Ki, Tawa. I won't make you go through it again, okay? Tsutum you know, because we have a good Tsutum over here. And he really does have Tsutum, I think. What's Tsutum? Tsutum means, yeah, ethical way of life, or morality, okay? Tsutum. Tsutum, Dang means and, okay? Dushuk means asceticism, meaning a spiritual practice. What's the greatest Dushuk in, according to Buddhism? Not getting angry when everything is just right to blow your top. That's the most difficult spiritual practice. We don't think it's so difficult to sit in the snow for 3 days or to whip your back with, you know, chains or, you know, starve yourself for 3 weeks. I was in Bombay, you know, they had this some... I'm not criticizing, okay? It's just stupid. This guy, like the greatest saint that ever came to Bombay, because he didn't eat for 373 days, and that was a new record, and there were tens of thousands of people going to see him, you know. And, okay. Chongjing Gi Dawa. To believe that... literally it says Chongjin means to believe that they are the best. Okay. Now our morality and spiritual practice is the best. Of course they are. They're great. Okay? So we have to add a word here. Add stupid. Okay? Add stupid. Or mistaken. Okay? To believe that mistaken moralities and mistaken spiritual practices, hardships, are wonderful. You know, and I'll give you some examples. I mean, in the Buddha's time, it would be like starving yourself, like not eating. You know, that's just causing trouble for your body, which is your precious motor car to get to nirvana. You don't want to abuse your body. Any spiritual practice which is aimed at abusing your body is just dumb, according to Buddhism. Okay? Another example would be, there was a practice in ancient India that said you should pierce your arms and legs and you know, experience the pain and meditate on the pain and stuff like that. In the meantime, you're ruining this very precious vehicle that you have to get to nirvana. You know, it's your responsibility as a Buddhist to take good care of your body. Okay, not to be attached to it and not be, what do you call it? You know, what's the word? People who are attached to their beauty. Yeah, not to be attached to the beauty of it and all that, but to just look at it as a very good car, and you have to maintain it. You have to take good care of it. You know, I've heard of people, you know, they do prostrations until they hurt their legs, and then they're walking with a cane or something like that. I mean, you have to, when it starts to hurt your body, you stop. You don't hurt your body. You don't hurt your precious body. You know, it's no big deal to get into some meditation posture which makes you suffer the most, you know, and so that you're concentrating on how well you're suffering rather than meditating on the Buddha or virtue or some great object. You know, no point to it. That's not the point. You have to take good care of your body. It is not a spiritual practice to abuse yourself. Okay? This wrong view says it is. Okay? That something, some kind of trouble that you give to your body or mind is some kind of good spiritual practice. Not. Okay? You have to take good care of yourself. Like that. Okay? Those are the 5 wrong worldviews. Okay? So now we have 10 major mental afflictions. One question and then we'll take a break. Oh yeah, that's a good idea. I'll tell you, she asked if explain, I believe, Tarta, extreme views. Like, I had mentioned how you could have the extreme view of thinking I never change. But how could you have the extreme view of thinking I don't exist? This is an intellectually learned extreme view, okay? Somebody says to you, the world is an illusion. You know, Michael Roach is empty. You know, shunya, ta. you know, whoa. And then you start to think he doesn't exist, or things like good and bad don't exist. I mean, it's very popular and very, very dirty and wrong to say that emptiness means there's no difference between good and bad, or that emptiness means there's no difference between liberation and this life. It's totally, completely, absolutely wrong. The viewpoint of the great Buddhist philosophers and of the Buddha himself is that emptiness means you must keep your morality. Because I'm empty means I'll be good, I'll be to you a tantric angel if you keep your morality totally pure. And I will also be to you your worst enemy if you keep your morality badly. In that sense, I'm empty. And that's a proof that you must be moral. So emptiness means you must be ethical. And any other way of explaining it is completely stupid. Okay, and there's no good and there's no bad, and you shouldn't care if you feel good or you feel bad. But the extreme that people go to is they say, once they hear that I don't exist the way you thought I existed, then I must not exist at all. Then it must be totally irrelevant. It's nihilism. Okay, it's some kind of nihilism. The kind especially that leads you to say, I can do whatever I want. You know, I don't have to keep my sexual conduct or sexual misconduct. It's all the same thing. You know, because everything's empty. You know, I heard about this Buddhism conference. It's quoted in a Buddhist book. They had a whole conference on Buddhist morality. And then one lady was checking out and her suitcase fell down and all these towels came out from the hotel. And she said, it's okay, it's empty anyway, you know. That's like classic tata. You know. Okay. Please take a break. Come back in like 10 minutes. I'll answer your question when you come back, okay? About regret. I'm thinking to change the word regret to feeling stupid. Seriously. It's the kind of thing where you've ruined something very precious by a moment's inattention. You know, like you're cleaning a chandelier and you're supposed to be holding something and you suddenly let go by accident and you smash this precious, expensive crystal chandelier. And I think for an educated Buddhist, you would have the same feeling right after yelling at someone that you would have of standing there and seeing this very expensive chandelier all ruined, because your mind just slipped for a minute and you ruined this very expensive thing. Or I can remember fixing a Volkswagen back in 1975, you know, Rinpoche's Volkswagen, and I just did a slight thing in, you know, I didn't pay attention and stripped this the whole cylinder block, and it was like $1,000 because of like 10 seconds of inattention, and you feel like stupid. And I think the regret, which is one of the four forces, is a Buddhist totally, fully understanding the implications and the consequences of having yelled at someone and then feeling stupid. You know, and then Nancy's question was, is it the same to feel stupid about something you know you did and that you remember you did? Or how do you get that same feeling about something you know you must have done stupid because you have a bald spot? In other words, if you read Buddhist scripture carefully, you can figure out where it came from. You can figure out exactly what you must have done to have every detail of your life as it is now. You know, the good and the bad. If you study the Jataka tales, which is the main function of the Jataka tales, you could figure out what you must have done to look like you look like, or to have the kind of life you're having, okay? Then she says, how do you get to feel stupid the same way for something you can figure out that you must have done, as you feel stupid about something you know very well you did? And I think it's just education. It's Buddhist education. It's learning karma properly and understanding properly karma very well. And that's all. Until you see the connection between what's happening in your life and what you must have done before, you can't feel as stupid as you do for things you just did. Or maybe we feel more stupid because we're already experiencing the result. You know, but it's all based on knowledge. Okay. I'll answer some questions, but we're going to be very late. Do you mind? Okay. All right, Hector. Jataka. J-A-T-A-K-A. There's all these stories of the Buddha's former life. And people think they're children's stories. And the only people who've ever translated them are Jataka Tales by Andy so-and-so in England who did it for children. It ain't for children. It is the description by an enlightened being of the subtle connections between deeds and their consequences, which you and I can never see on our own. So it's very important to read all of them. Then you get a real feeling for what's going to happen because of what you did. You know. And where did your life come from?
You know.
Yeah. Not necessarily. And there's a big debate in the Abhidharma, fourth chapter. You know, can multiple deeds create single consequences? And can single deeds create multiple consequences? And can a mixed deed, which you have a good deed with a bad motivation, create one consequence, or is it two consequences? And do they happen linked, or do they happen separately? And I don't think they have to be linked. You could experience the result of one consequence in one life and then get the result of the other one in another life. I think the fear that leads you to take refuge, for example, that particular fear might not be called a mental affliction. Okay? So maybe Abhidharma's wrong on that. Generally, I mean, according to the Abhidharma, now the higher schools don't talk about it that much. Okay? They don't talk about it that much. That's mainly a teaching from the psychology sections of Abhidharma's second chapter. But the higher schools don't talk that much about it. Okay. All right, we're going to go on. Excuse me? I'm sorry. She said, what's the difference between ignorance and innocence? Ignorance implies, in this case, the word in Tibetan almost means a kind of darkness. It's a mental darkness. It's like just not being able to think clearly about something. It's like having cataracts on your eyes or something. And you just don't see things properly because of a basic inability of your mind to see things clearly. And then the closest word I can think of in Tibetan for the word innocence is there is a teaching about special beings who have total innocence. And it's reflected in their bodily shape. In other words, they look a certain way because they don't have any mental afflictions at all. They are so innocent that their innocence reflects in a kind of special way in which their outer form is expressed. And that's in the secret teachings. And we can talk about it secretly. How's that? Okay. But innocence is more, in Buddhism, described as a lack of mental affliction. You know, you're just totally pure and you're like a child. You know, you don't have desire, you don't have anger, you don't have jealousy. And the way you move and the way you look, your physical body, because of that, changes. And And the purity of your mind starts to express itself in the physical appearance of your body, which is very, very beautiful and very different from what the kind of bodies that we have. And that's all in the that's in the secret teachings, and I can't talk much about that. Okay. All right. One is misunderstanding or not understanding something. It's kind of darkness about certain realities. And the other is just the total purity. Okay. I'm going to go through a few of the verses of Shantideva, Master Shantideva. Now you know what mental afflictions are. And the whole reading this week and the whole essence and the point of Master Shantideva's text at this point is now consider those things your mortal enemy. Okay? They are your mortal enemy. They are the enemy of mankind. Okay? Is the scourge of mankind is AIDS, or is it nuclear weapons, or is it communism, or what is the common enemy of every living being? You know, what is the enemy? What is our enemy? Is it Russians? Is it Chinese? You know, who's our enemy? You know, and you don't think much about enemies, I think, in America. I mean, we haven't had our country blown away by anybody, or, you know, nobody blew up the Empire State Building, or maybe we have this thing from the press about Arabs or something. You know, but who is the enemy? Terrorists, okay? I mean, who is the enemy? You know, who is the big enemy of mankind? And it's mental afflictions. Now you know who the enemy is, okay? And Master Shantideva says at this point, you must start to think of them as the enemy. You know, you have to think, don't think you don't have any enemies in your life. You know, you can say, I'm a pretty mellow guy. You know, there's that one guy, Richard, at the bookstore, that's not too cool, but I don't have any real enemies, you know, but you do. You have mortal enemies. You have certain enemies which are out to get you and which have brought you incredible suffering. And those are your mental afflictions. So Shantideva says, get into the mode of thinking of your own bad thoughts as the worst enemy you have. And then think of bad thoughts wherever they are as the enemy. You know, if you see a bad thought in one of your friends, go after him. You know, talk to your friend. Try to get them to understand what this enemy is doing to them. Okay, and he's very much into this mode of recognize the enemy and go seek out the enemy and then destroy the enemy. You know who the enemy is. You're the one who's making your life miserable. And he gives several examples. First of all, the definition of a mental affliction is that it's making you unhappy. Okay? I mean, if Buddhism, if future lives is BS, and if karma is all made up by some guys, and still mental afflictions are the enemy because they make you unhappy. From day to day, from moment to moment, they ruin your peace of mind. Okay? Your mind they make unhappy. If Buddhism is correct, they are also responsible for every bodily suffering in the world. They are ruining your mind, and they are ruining your body too. Okay, your body's getting old because you had mental afflictions. Cancer is caused by mental afflictions. Old age is caused by mental afflictions. When your face gets ugly, it's caused by your mental afflictions. Not the current ones, but the ones that created your body. Okay, and the way it is. And that's all caused by mental afflictions. So whether it's physical suffering in the world, all kinds of physical suffering, car accidents, cancer, AIDS, wars, all caused by mental afflictions. Or whether it's mental suffering, you know, all the doubts you ever had, all the anxieties you ever had, all the stress you ever had, all the bad habits you ever came into this world with, all the upsets you ever had, all the bad thoughts you have at work, fresh ones, all mental afflictions. The real enemy of mankind and the one responsible for all physical suffering in the world and all mental suffering in the world is the same. And it's those six guys. 10, okay? It's those 10. Mainly those 10. They are responsible for all the suffering in the world. Shantideva says, first, how long have they been doing it? I mean, a normal enemy, they screw you up for 6 months, 2 days, 2 hours. How long has mental afflictions been doing their job on you? If it's correct, if the theory of Buddhism is correct, they have been ruining your life forever. If you go backwards, they have been ruining your happiness forever. And your health, you know, forever. And if you don't do anything about it, they can hang around for a long time. You know, they say, Shantideva says, they're not like normal enemies. I mean, a normal enemy, you can outlast them. You know, sooner or later they'll die. You know, you know, that's some kind of comfort, right, sometimes. You can think, well, at least this guy will be out of here in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. You know, if I hang around long enough, this guy won't be here anymore. There's this comfort. Or if you work in a company and there's this really bad guy working next to you, you always have the comfort of knowing, probably he'll be gone in 3 years or 4 years. You know, if I just stick it out, most people leave this place. You know, he'll be gone. But mental afflictions are not like that. If you don't do anything about them, they have a permanent life, shelf life. You know, they will last forever. They'll always be with you. And they'll continue to cause you this kind of suffering. And Master Shantideva says, recognize the enemy. You know, recognize who they are and recognize what they ruin. They ruin your mental happiness and your physical happiness. And they've been doing it forever. Okay? And he gets into that. It's really cool. You can read about it. Then he gets into something very interesting. He says, make war. You know, make a decision tonight. You know, as a group, you know, here's I don't know how many people. Let's make war on the mental affliction. You know, sign up, volunteer now. Uncle Sam wants you. You know, you know, sign up for the war right now, tonight. And it's really nice. He says, sign up for war. Let's make war. Let's go to war. Make a declaration of war against mental afflictions. And it's really sweet the way he writes it. It's very nice. He says, let's all smash mental afflictions. And then he starts describing what it will be like. You know, he says, for example, in the world, if you have an enemy, what should you do with that enemy normally? I mean, if you're a Buddhist, say, be compassionate. You know, try to go, it's a bodhisattva vow to go make friends with them, to try. You know, assuming they're not like a Hitler, in which case you're supposed to avoid them. If the enemy is just someone that you're jealous of, or someone who mistakenly said something to you, or if it's anybody that you can reproach with, then go to them and try to make friends. You know, try to make up with them. But he says, mental afflictions, you know, put up with them, like humor them, or allow them for a single moment to have any kind of rest or peace. They just get stronger, and they fight back. You know, it's very interesting. If you try to, if you tonight decide that you are a soldier in the battle against the mental afflictions, and you go after them, where? In your own mind. I can tell you from having done it myself many times, and from having many students talk to me, it's no fun. Okay? It's very hard. And there's this very common phenomenon that as you start to go after your mental afflictions, they fight back. And they even seem stronger than before. You know, like if you're going to go after your pride or go after your jealousy, what you will find is, as soon as you're paying attention to it, it starts to intensify. Okay? And Master Shantideva says, expect it and be ready for it. They are going to put up a fight. You know, they're not going to die easy. And he says, interestingly, the reason they seem to put up a fight, or the reason they seem to be intensifying, is that you're just paying attention for the first time to what you've always had in your mind. You're just noticing for the first time what's been going on in your mind all along. They did not get stronger. You're just noticing for the first time what's going on. You just finally woke up to what they're doing in your mind. And they ruin your health. They ruin your life. Mental afflictions ruin your life. I always say, you know, if you're a creative, sensitive, intelligent American person, think about this aspect, especially if you live in Manhattan. It takes time to have a mental affliction. You know, it takes 5 to 10 minutes to have a mental affliction. You know, some of them take like 4 hours to have a mental affliction, you know. I mean, we are people who love to save time. You know, we invented computers. We invented subways, cars, and planes, you know. These things waste a good part of your life. You know, people say, oh, so-and-so is so creative. You know, so-and-so thinks of so many great ideas. How do they do it, you know? They're usually people who are just not wasting time on mental afflictions. It takes time to have a mental affliction. And you'll find out that if you start to fight with them and knock them out, you'll be a more creative person. You know, if you want to get better at your job or something, or even worldly stuff, go after the mental afflictions. They waste your time. They waste mind space. You only have so many thoughts in your lifetime. You have a limited number of thoughts in your lifetime. A certain percentage will be mental afflictions. The lower you can make that percentage, the more you'll have time to do other great things, creative things, virtuous things, you know, and you will find yourself getting more and more creative and more virtuous and more happy because you're not wasting time on mental afflictions. And that's another thing he says. He also says you have to put some effort into it. You know, like we always tell people, take this book home, take this journal home, list your three best actions during the day, list your three worst actions during the day. And like most people say, okay, that's a great idea. And they go home and they have these blank books sitting on, how many people got blank ACIP books sitting on there? Shut up, don't tell me. You know, they say, I don't have time. You know, Shantideva says, go kick some butt. You know, spend some time devoted to this warfare. You know, it'll be worth it. Okay, go spend some time. And then he says, look at these warriors who go out to fight, and somebody stabs them, or somebody hits them, or they take a bullet in the arm or something. They don't stop. I mean, if you really hate your enemy, if you hate his guts, a little shot, a graze wound, a flesh wound is not going to stop you. If you really hate your enemy, and he's like cuts you up a little bit, or breaks a small limb or something, you ain't going to stop. He says, don't stop. He says, you will take some hits. Expect it. You know, expect that you're going to have bad days. You know, the fight with the mental afflictions, if you get serious about it, you'll have some bad days. You'll have some very bad days. And you'll get very discouraged. You know, you'll say, I think I'm worse than I was a year ago. I don't think I should have even gone to that Bodhisattva Charitamrita kind of class. You know, I should have left them alone. You know, I opened this big can of worms, you know. I should have just left it, you know, because now my life is all turmoil. You know, I'm always like, I can't even walk through the Port Authority without thinking of all the things I did and trying to fight with my own mind, and I feel like a schizophrenic now. And I was much happier before. You know, and that's very common. When you start this warfare, Shantideva says, expect some warfare. There's going to be a fight. And it's not going to be all roses. You know, better roses, they say? Go fight. You're going to have to fight, and you will have some bad times. And he says, don't get discouraged. You know, he says, don't get discouraged. He says, don't be wimp. You know, he says, you can see, he points out to the example of fishermen. Pelman and I, I don't know if you remember, we were at a seashore and we watched this guy. He was standing waist deep in like 20 degree water, and he was getting clams out of this net. And he was standing there for like 4 or 5 hours and in this water, and he was like dying to kill these animals so that he could make like $40 or something, you know. And this was like, this is how he made his living. And Master Shantideva says, how do you make your living? If you're a Buddhist, how do you make your living? You fight mental afflictions. That's your job. And so don't be a wimp. You know, for your job at work, you spend 8 hours. You put up with all kinds of crap from your boss and from the other employees and from your customers and everybody else. You know, like you put up with all that stuff. You drag yourself there day after day after day. You get up early, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. You go through all these hardships just to feed your guts. So he says, don't be wimpy when you get to your mental afflictions. You know, go after them. And if it causes you to lose a few nights sleep, if you really get into mental affliction warfare, I can guarantee you, you'll lose a few nights sleep altogether. You know, you won't sleep all night. You start to have a bad thought, and if you really fight with it, you won't get to bed that night. Like dawn will come before it's over. It's happened. And is don't be wimpy. You know, you look at what you go through to feed your gut. You know, look at what you go through to pay your landlord. You get up every day, you drag yourself on the subway, you go down there, you do all that. You put up with all that crap at work. And then you say you can't spend a few minutes to fight your mental afflictions, which are causing you all your suffering. And they cause you suffering for your whole life and beyond. So he says, don't be a wimp. You know, this is war. And he's very adamant about it. He's very strong about it. You spend so much effort in your worldly life, and you put up with so much pain to get the things you want. This is much more important. So don't do it half-assed. You know, people say, I don't have time to meditate. You know, I don't have time to do 20 minutes of meditation, but I do have time to go for 10 hours to work. You know, it doesn't make sense. Go, you gotta fight. You gotta put up some fight. And it takes some time. and you won't get any results otherwise. And these are the cause of all suffering, of every unhappiness and all your physical suffering. So spend some time on it. You had a question? Yeah. Yeah, he asked, what's the best way to fight a mental affliction? I think the Lojong Si Gema, the 8 verses, says, Nyomong Gema Ta, Dong Ne Tsenpar Dopa Sho. Dong Ne Tsenpar Dopa Sho, which means identify the enemy, seek out the enemy, destroy the enemy. He's very clear. He says, and do not give it a moment in your mind. You know, there's this theory in modern psychology, okay? Express your anger, you know, let it out. It's like saying, if you want a diet, eat as much as you can. You know, because sooner or later the desire for food will stop. When you've filled your stomach like 3 times more than you... it's crazy. It's like the cure for anger is to get mad, you know? And Master Shantideva would say, crazy. You know, he'd say, Donne Tsenpar Dopa Shok means the minute you identify the enemy, smash him. You know, do not put up with a mental affliction in your mind. Once you know it has come up, then go after it and fight with it. You know, don't just sit there and say, okay, let's see if it passes. You know, like that. He says, be proactive and go after it and use your knowledge and fight. Go fight right away. Don't put up with it for 5 minutes. Why? What's it? 64, okay? 64 karmic imprints per finger snap. You wait 5 minutes, it's a lot. Okay? It's a lot. Each mental affliction has its own antidote, but the main antidote, you know, the main antidote is to understand the emptiness of the object that you're having the mental affliction over. You want that guy's wife? You know, think about it. Where do you get pleasure? Where does pleasure come from? It comes from keeping your morality. So the worst thing you could do, the stupidest thing you could do, would be to break your morality to get pleasure. You know, that would be crazy for a Buddhist. Understand the emptiness of the object. Understand why that object is there. You want a nice computer, $4,000 under price? Are you going to steal one? You know, or buy a stolen one? No, because that's the way to lose a computer. You know, I mean, use your wisdom, especially about the object. You know, understand where the object is coming from. And that's the best way. The other neat way to stop your mental afflictions is to consider what they do to you, karmically. You know, and to study what they do to you. You know, like a few minutes of jealousy will just ruin many events in your future. You know, hours and days of your future will be ruined by a few feelings of jealousy. A few minor feelings of jealousy will have major karmic effects in your future. Nothing is lost. Karma is a total ecology. Nothing is lost. No energy is lost. Everything is recorded perfectly on your mind stream. You can't think of the disadvantages of mental affliction. That's why in this text, as you read it tonight, the first thing he does is go through the understanding how they hurt you. Because if you understand how they hurt you, you won't put up with them anymore. Okay. Somebody had a question. She says it's kind of hard to go from 0 to 100 miles per hour in one day. Well, if you like to suffer, then do it more slowly. You know, it's very simple. Nothing is lost. You know. I think what you're saying is that you would get a little weird if you really tried to identify every single negative thought that came up in your mind. You know, I mean, life would become a little weird. You could hardly get through the Port Authority. I can tell you from experience, okay? You know, you'd be constantly stopping to, oh my God, well, can't look at that. You know? And Master Shantideva, there's a point at where he says, I think we talked about it. If I gave you a bowl full of water, right up to the brim, you know how it sometimes goes over the brim but doesn't fall out? And he says, if I gave you a bowl of water like that and said, get to the back of the Quaker church with that bowl of water without spilling any, please, you would walk to there and you would spill some. And then he says, okay, let's try it again. And he fills up a little with water. And then he gets this really nice knife, butcher knife. And he stands behind you and he says, I'm going to walk with you down to the end of the Quaker church. And if you drop one drop, this knife's coming down on you. And it's a question of willpower. You know, if you really don't want to drop water, you'll make it. Understand that every single mental unhappiness that you've ever had and every kind of physical problem you've ever had were caused by one thing only. And go after them. You know, quit being patient with the mental afflictions. You know, quit putting up with them. They're causing you all your suffering. And if it means that, that's where he gets into the hardship part, and you'll read it. If it means that you act weird going to the Port Authority, well, God bless. That's okay. You know, you are going to act weird for a while. And you are going to be a strange person for a while. That's the cost of fighting the mental afflictions. And you have to pay that price. You know, maybe you have to quit your job. You know, maybe you have to cut down your hours. Maybe you have to take a cut in pay. Maybe you have to do other things. He says, do it. You know, to win this war, anything is worth it. Because after that, everything will change. You know, he says, to win this war, do whatever you have to do. You put up with so much to do all the other things that you want, you know. You put up with so much to go to work all day long and struggle to get food and house and stuff like that that's just going to dissolve. And then you don't have 10 minutes to meditate, you know. Or you don't want to be uncomfortable fighting your mental afflictions. I don't like to be uncomfortable being schizophrenic about myself, you know. I'd rather just have my pride than to be constantly examining myself. It paralyzes me. This is part of the cost of fighting the mental afflictions. And Shantideva says, get ready for it. It's going to cost that. And and try to understand the investment that you have to make and then make it. Because they ruin your life. And they've ruined your life forever. And they are your only enemy. They have ruined you for your whole life. They've made unhappy. Every kind of problem you've ever had was your mental afflictions. So go after them. Fight with them. Take them on. You know, he's very adamant about it. Okay, one more question, then we'll stop. What's the difference between repressing your anger and making it stop? I'll show you, I'll give you an example from Scripture, okay? Repressing it and wrestling with it? Oh, okay. By the way, in Buddhism, if you can repress it, which means if you can make it stop for a while, even though you can't make it stop permanently, you have what? You just prevented a lot of trouble for yourself, you know. And okay, it's artificial. You know, in Buddhism, there's two ways to get rid of mental affliction. You can do lojong, the first parts of lojong, which means you can, let's say about anger, you know, you can think about, try to think of that person as your friend in your past life. Or try to understand that anger just gives you an ulcer. Or try to understand that anger is not going to get you the raise you want if you yell at your boss. You know, try to understand all these worldly things about it that will repress your anger. And then they say, but if you really want to go after your mental affliction, there's only one way. And what is it? Must understand emptiness. Must understand emptiness. Okay? There's only one way to get rid of your mental afflictions permanently, and that's emptiness. Okay. Does that mean you look at your anger in a certain way and press your eye here, I guess it's here, and the anger dissolves or something like that? You know, no. Okay. That's not what emptiness means of the anger. Does it mean you just let it float through your mind peacefully and let it go? Yeah. 64 karmic imprints during the first millisecond while you let it go have just been planted in your mind and will have their terrible results in your mind. No, it doesn't mean that. It means, in the case of a screaming boss, understand that he's screaming at you because you created it. And stop screaming. Okay? That's all. Stop having anger. And stop even letting yourself be angry, because the thought is raw karma, right? We talked about it. Karma in its rawest form is the feeling of anger. Before you say anything or do anything, the feeling of anger is the worst kind of, and most powerful kind of karma. Leni Sembo Dande Che, fourth chapter, Abhidhamma Kosha, right? Raw karma is the mental karma. It's the thoughts. And that you have to avoid, because that one collects at the rate of a few thousand per hour or something. Yeah. This idea of sort of removing yourself from your anger and watching, you know, like almost like floating out of your body and getting back and watching yourself be angry and observe it and try not to. I've heard a lot of Buddhist books say, try not to attach to it, or try not to own it, or try not to have any ownership about it. Just watch it from the side and watch yourself get angry. That's bullshit. And I've never seen anything like that in any authentic Buddhist book. And show me. You know, show me I'm wrong. You know, yeah. No, well, I'm talking about her particular idea. Show me a scripture that says that. I know that that's an idea, that's a Dharma rumor floating around. Show me any scripture that says that. I've never seen one. You know, you can observe your breath, and you can observe your thoughts as an exercise in being present or aware. But I have never seen and by the way, if you want to know the bottom line, it's in the last verse tonight's reading. And somebody says a very similar idea. They say, it would be selfish to go into nirvana before everybody else. So, therefore, I will work on other people's mental afflictions. And I will not work on my own, so that they can get to nirvana first, and then I'll come later. You know, and this is some kind of, you know, idea that's floating around too, you know. Don't be selfish. You get to nirvana last, let them go to nirvana first. What you're saying is, you keep your mental afflictions, and you try to worry about other people's mental afflictions first. You know, first of all, you don't even know that another person on this planet has any mental affliction. You don't know that for sure. Unless you've reached the path of seeing or something, and you can read other people's minds, you don't know for sure that every person in this room is not a person who achieved enlightenment 3 trillion years ago. Okay? You don't know. So Shantideva says, don't worry about other people's mental afflictions. If they seem to have a mental affliction, try to help them. You know, on the assumption that maybe they're really having a mental affliction. But mainly work on your own. And reach nirvana first. It doesn't do any good to wait and hold, you know, hold on to your anger and your desire and your jealousy for the good of others. You know, I mean, it's crazy. It doesn't make any sense. Okay, there's no such thing. Shantideva says that's not what the book meant. There is a book that says there's three kinds of Buddhists. You know, the kind who leads people to nirvana, the kind that goes with them to nirvana, and the kind that pushes them in front into nirvana. But it means something different. It doesn't mean that. It doesn't make any sense to say, I'll keep my anger and jealousy and hatred for the sake of others and let them lose theirs first. You know, it doesn't make any sense. Shantideva says, moreover, you wouldn't know how to help them until you removed your own. So it doesn't make any sense. Take care of yours first, and then go help other people to take care of this. You have one last question, then you got to go. What I'm saying is that ultimately you're right. But what I'm saying is that when someone seems to exhibit a mental affliction or the result of a mental affliction by getting angry at something, we can never be exactly sure that they really have a mental affliction. They may be some saint who is trying to teach us something. And it's very important to think that way, as far as not judging other people. But if another person is exhibiting behavior which harms another person, as a Buddhist, you have to step in and try to stop it. Now, maybe they're a great saint who's trying to teach. Maybe A is a great saint who's trying to teach B a good lesson. But if you see it as a bodhisattva, you have to try to stop it. But you cannot use hatred. You should reserve a part of your mind that says, maybe there's something else going on. You know, if you see something that you think is wrong or something, you should reserve a part of your mind that says, Maybe there's something profound here going on that I don't know about. But based on everything I know, I have to act against this thing. I have to fight against this thing. That's all right. That's not contradictory. It could be that A is a great saint, or even a Buddha, who's trying to teach B a lesson by screaming at them. And then you can try to break it up and stop them. And what happens? They collect a great virtue, and you collect a great virtue by doing the opposite thing. It's possible. No problem. Okay? Got to think about that one. All right. I think we'll just go straight to the prayers because we're so late, okay? Was there any... Was there some announcement? No, that was it. Okay. Okay, so have a good fight this week, okay?